the last speaker of this morning, Steve Strother, University of Toronto and the Rutner Institute. He's going to speak about written stability across pre-processing pipelines for fMRI.
Thanks, Wells. Let's see, hopefully this will... great. I've also changed my talk title a little bit, but it still includes the old title. That's why it says including analysis methods. Okay. This might be a little sticky. Let's try...
Down arrow.
There we go. Okay, so an overview of the talk. It's basically set up as why, how, and what. First, I just want to quickly go over pipelines and thinking of them as optimizable metamodels. Then how might we go about optimizing these pipelines? There are lots of possible metrics. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but I'll specifically talk about receiver operating characteristic curves with some simulation results, and then also data-driven ways of generating ROC curves, some of which work and some of which sort of work. Then two ideas that have been near and dear to my own heart, reproducibility and prediction, and putting them together in the framework I've been working on for a while called N-pairs. We use both prediction and reproducibility. And then four examples using reproducibility or prediction and reproducibility to do things like compare to ROC results, optimize a pipeline, look at the sensitivity of reproducibility to changes in SPM statistical parametric map Z values, and a final example using reproducibility to measure neural spatial scale in high resolution animal imaging. So let's get started. So just to make sure we're all thinking about the same thing, this is a fMRI processing pipeline. And hopefully I'll work out what to push in a moment. There we go. They have lots of steps. These steps all interact. Clearly everything down here is dependent. If you happen to do this one first, or this guy here, maybe you do that first. They're not always done in the same order in the same labs. This is not all the steps that everyone uses, and not everyone uses all these steps. And that's just to generate the data that you're going to feed into hopefully the next part of the slide. Oh, there it is. Finally, the analysis engine, and this, as I showed you yesterday, interacts with choices that you make in this pipeline. Specifically, we looked at intensity normalization, which hopefully is going to come up. Whoop, there it is. Okay, so it's just slow. And I don't have time to talk about this anymore today, but yesterday we saw that there's an interaction between choices in intensity normalization, the task, the age of the group, and the offset that you end up with in the white matter, which is probably not a good thing because white matter, we pretty sure, doesn't activate in these experiments. Okay. So why should we worry about testing these pipelines? Well, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And that's a... I really believe that. There's no such thing as the right model, although I wish Steve Smith luck in his quest for the optimal way of analyzing fMRI data. It certainly served the field very well. But I say this on good authority. Box said it in 1976, and that and a whole lot of other really interesting things about applied statistics are covered in a paper by Mark Snester that I highly recommend you read. And I think you have access to these slides, so these references will be available to you. So if you believe that all models are wrong but some are useful, then the goal is to quantify and optimize what useful means. So maybe that's the role of reproducibility. So there's a wide range of software available for building fMRI processing and analysis pipelines, but typically most of us implicitly hope but do not test that our results are robust to the exact techniques, algorithms, and software packages that we happen to use. And this is another, I think, major source of noise in the literature. And it turns out, if you go look at the literature, that we actually know little about what constitutes an optimal pipeline. We know quite a lot about what constitutes an interesting range of algorithms at each step in the pipeline, but there isn't actually that much literature looking at whole pipelines and the interactions of those steps and what combinations of the many choices you can make might be optimal in some sense. And this is particularly true in cognitive and clinically relevant tasks. If you actually go look at the methodology literature, a lot of it is in the visual and motor system, where you have nice, big, strong, bold activations and maybe alignment problems that are not quite as bad as they are in many of the cognitive tasks we look at. And of course, many of these things get even worse as you move into clinical groups. And there are also major issues encountered when you move into children and the middle-aged and older subjects, who I think represent age-matched controls for many of the clinical populations that we're interested in. So for all those reasons, I think this is an important problem. There are many ways to do this. I'm not going to cover all of these, so we can definitely use simulations, and I'm certainly not the first person to talk about and think of using them, and I highly encourage you to go back and read the paper by Skidlarsky, who used simulations to look at processing pipelines back in 1999. It's well worth reading, and many people have used them since. There are also a large number of data-driven approaches for trying to optimize pipelines. You can try and minimize p-values, which I personally think is a terrible thing to do, but people do it anyway. There are a large number of model selection techniques from the statistical literature, AKE, minimum description length, Bayesian information criterion, Bayes evidence. We're starting to hear more and more about and resampling procedures like cross-validation. I'm not going to talk about any of these analytic procedures, but I will pick up on cross-validation. And then looking at reproducibility in particular, there's a classic technique of intra-class correlation coefficients. I'm not going to talk about that. Not that it isn't a useful idea, but it's very closely tied to variance decomposition in ANOVA-style models, and I'm looking for a more general metric than that. There are a range of empirical ROC techniques. I'm going to briefly talk about the lower bound on the ROC proposed by Nandy, and then spend a little more time on the mixed multinomial model proposed by Genovese. My own approach has been to use split half resampling, which I will then talk about in the context of prediction and reproducibility. And these references are just to help you out if you happen to be looking up some of this. It's not an exhaustive list by any means. Okay, so simulations. I'm going to briefly show you some results. This is the one we happen to have worked with a bit, but there are many in the literature. It's a very simple block design with about 30 images because we're interested in trying to understand detection sensitivity in small samples. It is sort of inherited some of my PET background, so it has a cortex to white matter ratio of 4:1, which happens to be in the FDG literature. There's a mean Gaussian amplitude in 16 blobs of around 3% over the background. It's got a 5% pixel noise in the background. And we do something that's perhaps a little different than many of the simulations you find in the literature. We put in a correlated long-range correlated network across the amplitudes of these Gaussian blobs and look to see what impact of having a correlated network has on our detections in the models that we're looking at. And one of our goals has been to try and use a very large number of models on this relatively simple simulation and then gradually make the simulation more complex. So one of the things that we do with respect to the correlated networks is we look at the dynamic range of the network, which is something people tend not to talk about. But of course, if there's no, if you can think of it as network variability in the amplitudes of these Gaussians, then it doesn't matter if they're correlated, you aren't going to be able to detect it. And you have to choose how big that is, so we actually vary it from a very small value to a large value relative to the background noise. So you can think of that as the good physiological variability relative to the bad noise variability. And of course you measure these with ROC curves, and just to make sure we're all on the same page, an ROC curve is the true positive. That's the active voxels classified as active, which is also sensitivity plotted on the vertical axis, against the false positives, the probabilities of a false alarm plotted on the horizontal axis. And we, as many people have done, focus on the left-hand corner of this curve from with false positives from 0 to 0.1, and the assumption that if you have a much higher false positive rate, you won't be that interested in the technique. And lots of people have used these. So how do you go about generating data for these? It's somewhat compute intensive. You go ahead and generate lots of null data sets, in our case 500, and you feed each one through your detector, and you get all these noisy null sets, and you go in and, in our case, look at the peak values of the activation locations and generate a null distribution. And you do the same thing with the active images, the alternative. You feed them through whatever detector you happen to be interested in looking at. Again, go in and look at the voxel locations, and you generate the alternative hypothesis, and then you move a threshold across the bottom here, and you trace out your ROC curve. So that's all a relatively easy thing to do, even if it takes a bit of compute time. And you get curves that look like these. So just focusing on the left-hand side here, we're plotting the area under the ROC curve on the vertical axis, and this dynamic network interaction term relative to the noise on the horizontal axis here. And I don't really want to spend any time going into all these models. This is the GLM here, which sort of dies as the noise increases in the activation peaks, which is what you would expect because it's got no mechanism for knowing that the noise in the activation peaks, which is going up relative to the background, shouldn't just be lumped into the noise term. And that means that the variance in your two conditions is not equal, and that's one of the assumptions under the standard t-test. So this is one of the reasons we've put this sort of structure in to try and look at that kind of effect. Here's another example where a linear discriminant is dying. This is the multivariate case. Again, we're violating an assumption here that the covariance is equal between the two classes that we happen to be looking at. But we have a series of models that can fix that, for example, quadratic discriminants. And this here is with a moderate amount of network correlation, and this is with a lot, one. They're essentially totally correlated. The point I want to make is there's a wide dynamic range of signal detection, even in very simple simulations across a broad range of models that are being used by different people in the literature at the moment. So remember, this is just at the output of the pipeline. Just by changing the model there, you can significantly change your signal detection ability, ignoring what you happen to have done in processing the data before it actually got into the pipeline. So I just want to make the point that at least in small sample sizes, which I'm particularly interested in for clinical subjects because we want to get them into the scanner and out again as fast as possible, maybe do lots of tasks in a relatively short period of time. So we're trying to find models that are relatively fast to run that have high signal detection in small amounts of data. Okay, so that's the story of simulation. So yes, I think I'm all right here. Okay. The problem with simulations, though, of course, is we really have no idea if they match our real data. If we knew exactly what the signal structure of our real data was, we wouldn't have needed to do the fMRI experiment in the first place, which means our simulations are some sort of unknown approximation to our real data. So it would also be good to have some data-driven detection procedures, and maybe try and iterate to get our simulations to match the kind of results we're getting out of the data-driven procedures. And there are a number of those. One of the interesting ones is proposed by Nandy, and there's a more recent paper from 2007, where you go ahead and measure the probability that a voxel is identified as active, and then the probability of Y over F that an inactive voxel is identified as active, and then the probability of Y versus that is a lower bound on the ROC, and you have to get some measure of this probability of Y given F, and his proposal was that you get it out of a resting state scan. The problem there, of course, is that that's going to be a bit hard to apply to post hoc experiments where you didn't specifically do resting state scans that would allow you to get the probability of Y given F, but given the fact that many people are now looking at resting states, maybe it is actually a feasible procedure. So that's one idea. And remember, that didn't actually include the idea of replication. So the key idea there is that you do that second resting state scan. But what about reproducibility as an actual measure? So why do we care about it? Well, these are the ideas that I care about it. I think it's a fundamental criterion for a result to be considered scientific. And since we're doing science, that's something we should pay some attention to. Smaller p-values do not by themselves imply a stronger likelihood of the result repeating itself, unless you happen to be in the asymptotic limit and you have exactly the right model. And since you're probably never in either of those two places, I'm quite happy to support this statement. And it's particularly true in small samples. And we just heard that most of the literature may actually be in the small sample regime in group studies. Whoops, I guess I hit the wrong button. I would argue that for good scientific practice, it's necessary but not sufficient to build a measure of replication into your experimental design and data analysis. So I don't think you should actually think of understanding whether your results are replicable as a nice add-on. I think it's actually something you should fundamentally think of designing into your experiments. And that's why trying to understand these different techniques that might allow you to get a measure of replication are important, because we're presumably going to want the one that's most sensitive and is least disruptive on our current experimental designs. It also, reproducibility results are data-driven, and they avoid the problem of having to assume that I've built a simulation that actually relates to my data in some meaningful way, other than to actually understand issues about model detection itself, which is related to the math of the models. So there's at least two major techniques in the literature. One of them was proposed by Genovese in 1997. It's actually been around quite a while, and a number of people have used it and proposed extensions to it, and here's a couple of them. Actually, there's a more recent paper in NeuroImage. This is what the model looks like. It's a binomial mixture model, and the reason that it involves reproducibility or replication is it explicitly includes a number of replications of your experiment, in which you assume that it's an identical draw from exactly the same set of distributions. And that's this value m here. And in order to estimate the three parameters, this was originally a lambda. It's undergone some strange transmutation. So it's this guy down here, mixing fraction. In order to estimate the three parameters, the mixing fraction, the probability of a true activation, and the probability of a false activation, you need at least three replications. We looked at this a number of years ago, and we found that with only three replications, the results we were getting were extremely noisy. And it looked as though we needed to go up to more like half a dozen, or preferably even more, replications of our experiment. And since we were particularly interested in within group studies across multiple tasks, it wasn't really a very viable measure. And I happened to have thought about split half resampling at the time, and I only need two replications to actually apply that, so that's why we went down that road and have continued to go down that road. In the meantime, other people have gone ahead and developed this procedure. In particular, Morgan Hock, who's doing his PhD with Steve Smith, and he's kindly provided me some slides of what they currently think of this approach. So here's an example of using it where you're comparing ROC curves. Oh, actually, I just realized I forgot to point out that. So what you do is you vary the threshold on your data that is in order to turn it into zeros and ones, and you count the number of active voxels at a particular threshold that you happen to have, and then you can go ahead, given the number of replications, and estimate the three parameters, the mixing fraction, the probability of true activation, the probability of false activation. And it's these two guys that you plot to get an ROC curve as a function of the threshold. So you move the threshold over a whole series of ranges, estimate again at each one of those thresholds, this PA, and I'm sorry, that should be PI. That's this guy here. Probability of false activation. And one assumes that the mixing fraction is a fixed value, which is the point raised here. Comparisons between some ROC curves from three different pre-processing pipelines clearly need to use a common mixing proportion because we're assuming there's a common underlying activation in the actual data, even if something is changing as a result of the different processing pipelines. So this is some of Morgan's data. This is the chance ROC curve. Let's see, the bottom curve is I think that says none. Can anyone else read that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So that, I guess, means no pre-processing pipeline. MC is motor correction, which is the second curve, and then motor correction and regressing out the motor parameters is the third curve, so you're sort of seeing things improve, as you might expect. However, all is not well in the land of estimates from binomial mixture models, unfortunately. And the problem is this need for a joint lambda, which can be written down in this form here, which we're now going to ignore. But just bear in mind that the underlying comparison of pre-processing curves requires the idea that there is a true underlying activation fraction that lives in the data. And this model is trying to get at that. And the problem is that in trying to determine this joint lambda value, we run into a whole series of problems. And the most common method in the literature for trying to deal with it has been to just go ahead and estimate independent models at the different thresholds and across the different pipelines and then use an average of that value as the joint value. Unfortunately, that leads to a whole host of problems. At low Z statistic thresholds, the results in most voxels are above threshold more than once, which causes instabilities in the values you get for lambda, and there's a high uncertainty associated with the value at low thresholds. Also, the estimated lambda tends to converge to an average of 0.5, if you don't constrain the range of thresholds that you go over. So now we suddenly have some empirical constraints we have to apply in estimation in this particular model. And unfortunately, in many of the papers where people have used the Genovese approach, exactly how they got this lambda estimate is not at all clear. So just a word for all those of you who are writing methodology in papers, please try and tell us enough so that we could actually have a vague hope of replicating the experiment. That's one of my pet peeves, but that's actually one of the goals of the scientific literature. Although I know there are many constraints operating on you, pushing you not to do that, fight against those constraints. So the first problem is that these lambdas are both unstable at some threshold values and tend towards values of 0.5, somewhat independent of the data, which is probably not a good thing. The second problem is that the activation shape alters the values of lambda that you actually get. The model really assumes that you have fixed activation, placement, height, and noise at all locations across the subject. And of course, if you have, since we don't usually have square constant amplitude activations turning up in our data sets, one would hope that by going to something like a Gaussian, it would still be stable. And unfortunately, at least according to Morgan's data, it isn't. Here's the attempt to measure a simulation value of 0.1 as a function of threshold. Here's 0.1 here. For Gaussian activation amplitudes, here's what you get when you have a square constant amplitude activation. So it works well over here, doesn't work so well over here. So it seems that Steve and Morgan have decided that this is not a particularly good model. The only reason I'm spending this amount of time on it is it has been widely used in the literature. So there's a lack of point-to-point correspondence across subjects, which will cause the model problems. There's differences in activation magnitude and size, differences in noise and mean variance. I don't actually know what that means. And the binomial mixture model framework cannot reliably estimate the mixing proportion when the activation shape is not of uniform strength across activated boxes. So it's a great idea. I think it's a nice model. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to work. And we're going to the next slide. However, I have something that does work. Don't buy a car from this man. Okay. There are these two other ideas in the literature which we can do in a resampling framework. One of them is prediction and one of them is reproducibility. And let's look at the prediction piece. Here is, given some data with design matrix and some images, we go ahead, we estimate our model. We don't have to say what model it is, and we get an SPM. That's standard SPM estimation. That's where many papers stop. If we happen to have a replicated set of data, or doesn't have to be the same size, a test set, we can, since we have a model here, that we can now use that model to go ahead and predict our design matrix values. So, for example, if the design matrix was class labels, baseline and activation, we can take this model in this data set and use it to predict the class labels. So this is the standard prediction algorithms that are now filling a lot of the literature. We get this predicted design matrix. We can compare it to the actual design matrix since we designed the experiment, and we get a prediction accuracy estimate. So that's standard prediction metric. But we can go ahead and extend this. We can flip these two guys, now make what was our test split, our training set, go through this estimation procedure again, get another prediction accuracy estimate. But now we have two independent SPMs, and we can go ahead and use those to get a reproducibility estimate. And this is the basic underlying idea behind the N-pairs procedure. You take this idea of cross-validation, training and test resampling, you go ahead and make the split equal, so it's a split half, in order to get maximum power in these two SPMs, and then you bring them together and measure some metric that says how similar are these two SPMs off these two independent splits. So how can you go ahead and bring them together? There are multiple ways you could do this. We're using a relatively simple way. We plot all the voxel values from one of these SPMs against all the voxel values from the other. So each point here is the value of a particular voxel. And we measure the correlation coefficient. The correlation coefficient is related, the variance along this axis here, the signal axis will be 1 plus the correlation coefficient, and the variance along this orthogonal noise axis will be 1 minus the correlation coefficient. And if there's no reinforcement of the pattern, you'll just get a blob, a circular blob like that, at least in the case of Gaussian noise, and you can extract out noise and signal histograms, and these are those overlaid on, there's a little Gaussian line under there. So that's sort of an uninteresting case. But in the interesting case, as these two signals tend towards being similar, this thing will elongate in that direction. It's actually the degree of that elongation that the correlation coefficient is measuring. Because remember, the variance in the signal direction is 1 plus the correlation coefficient, and the variance in the noise is 1 minus. And we can go ahead and extract the global signal to noise ratio measure, which the correlation value is monotonically related to. So the standard deviation of the signal will be 1 plus the variance in the signal direction, which is noise plus signal, minus the noise divided by the noise. So you end up with a global signal-to-noise ratio, square root of 2R over 1 minus R. So there's this monotonic relationship between this value of R and this measure of excess signal variance from these two independent SPM patterns. You can also do something else, and remember, I haven't specified a model. You can take the noise on the noise axis, measure its variance, and rescale the values along the signal axis by that uncorrelated noise measure, which puts any model's values onto a common statistical z-score scale, provided it's Gaussian. And it often is pretty close, so you know this is quite good for engineering work. Here's an example. There's a Gaussian line under there with the noise histogram sitting on the top, and here's the signal histogram rescaled into a z-score range. So I can take any model's data and put it onto an SPM z-score in this framework and get out this global signal-to-noise measure. You can go ahead and compare these EMPAIR's reproducibility values to simulations, and they sort of monotonically match except for this guy here, which is a general linear model with pooled variance estimates. And this is one of the problems with reproducibility by itself. It's actually a biased measure with some unknown bias, and you don't know what that unknown bias is. And pooled variance is a significantly biased model. I mean, I even saw these results a few days ago, so I haven't actually explored them, so I'm guessing that's what it is. So one of the problems with reproducibility by itself is it may not even monotonically scale in terms of signal detection performance across models in the same way that ROC curves do. This was using global measures of reproducibility, including all voxels. This is just using a little patch around the peaks of the Gaussians, because we wondered if the fact that we had all the noise voxels in the global measure was tending to cause this effect, but it still was there when we looked at the local peak, which is what you're looking at in the ROC curves. So be wary of all... reproducibility is not enough by itself, although it can be extremely useful, as I will show you in a moment. And we're going to skip over that one, because we're going to run out of time, and go straight to this one. So one of the things you can do is plot, using the EMPAIR structure, your prediction values as a whole, as a function of maybe model parameters, in this case number of principal components, that might could be number of independent components, and a modification in the processing pipeline, in this case a relatively subtle change in cosine detrending. And along the horizontal we have reproducibility. So you can see that you plot out some sort of trajectory in this space. Where you'd like to be is up in the upper right-hand corner, because you'd like perfect prediction and infinite signal-to-noise in your result. Well, you're not going to get there, but at least it's a goal worth striving for. So we know that we want these curves to move up towards this upper right-hand corner. So in that sense, this is just like an ROC curve, except in the ROC curve with true positives versus false positives, you want to move to the upper left-hand corner. We can swap the scale, I guess. So what you can do is measure the Euclidean distance from that upper right-hand corner, and then for your two different pipelines or model manipulations, measure the change, delta M on average, across, for example, a number of subjects that you get in that Euclidean distance. That's putting an equal weight on the prediction and on the reproducibility, because it's unclear to me at the moment which one is more important, but you could obviously reweight those if you had some evidence that one should be reweighted relative to the other. Or if you were more interested in prediction, for example, or reproducibility. So what happens when you do this? This paper just came out in NeuroImage. So we did this in a motor data set, and we looked at a whole series of pre-processing steps across two models, the general linear model and a two-class linear discriminant, two-class CDA. Here's all the delta M values for 16 subjects. So this is with this pre-processing step being turned on or off in a pipeline that in this case and this case includes 6 millimeters of smoothing and 2 cosine temporal detrending. Here's the standard deviations. So you can see that the slice timing across all these subjects, because of the relatively large standard deviations here, doesn't seem to have a significant effect, which you can test using Wilcoxon's match pair rank sum, because you have 16 independent subjects. What if we look at motion correction? And the way we did this, when we found something didn't work, we turned it off and left it out. So slice timing was left out. You move to motion correction. Now you find something quite interesting. It appears that in the general linear model, in this particular data, although there's a lot of variance across subjects, so maybe it's doing something interesting in some subjects and not others, on average it's not significant, that it interacts in a completely different way with the multivariate model. In fact, it goes in the opposite direction, so it actually gets better for the multivariate model, but it appears that it's nowhere near as variable across the subjects, the impact within this estimation procedure. So you end up with a significant impact of motion correction in this model, but not in this model, in this framework. If you go down to spatial smoothing, it's just uniformly significant, although there's again some difference in the variance interaction across subjects. There's lots of potential, all of them are significant, but there's lots of different variance values here for different filtering techniques. I won't go into the details, but you can see that it comes up with sort of what you would expect. Spatial smoothing and temporal detrending is very important. That's what we already know. But there is some interesting information about maybe what's going on in individual subjects, particularly in these variance terms, and an example of that is seen here in the motion correction. So that's an early attempt to try and use this framework to optimize pipelines, and there's that and a number of other papers in the literature that have used that. So that's one example of the potential use of these metrics. This is the data set that I showed you yesterday, looking at data as a function of age. And what I'm going to use it for right now is to just show you the sensitivity of the change in the SPMZ values relative to these reproducibility numbers that we're getting. In this particular data, the prediction values are very close to 1, so there's really no curve to optimize in that prediction reproducibility space. So we looked at this across a whole range of processing pipelines. I guess the details don't actually matter for what I'm about to show you, over a couple of models, the general linear model and the multivariate CDA. Oop, come here. Okay, it's thinking. So focusing on the left here, you can go ahead for one pipeline and compare the GLM Z-scores with just motion correction and the GLM Z-scores with motion correction and then regressing out the motion parameter estimates. And you get the scatter plot, and I can't actually see it that clearly here, but this line here, I believe, is the line of identity. Is that what it looks like? Yeah, I think it is. And you can see that this whole scatter plot is rotated to the right a little bit. And you can actually measure that by measuring the principal component slope of this scatter plot, which, as suggests, it's a little to the right. In other words, doing motion parameter estimate regression has tended to improve these values by, on average, 7%. So you can do that across all these pipelines and plot the change in the reproducibility for this pipeline and model and this pipeline and model. So you can plot all those reproducibility changes against these PCA scatter plots, the extent to which the, on average, the SPMZ value increased. And this is the data that you get, suggesting that while a little noisy, is actually quite a sensitive measure of small changes under this simple PCA slope metric. So we're currently exploring this, trying to understand what the outliers are, you know, what the noise is, etc. But the initial evidence suggests that across a broad range of models, pipelines, and ages here, this is a relatively sensitive measure of what you're doing on average to your SPM Z-scores. Okay, so that was the second example. I guess it was the third, actually. And now the last example, measuring the spatial scale of cat orientation columns. So this is work done in collaboration with Fenghao Zhao and Xu Chen, who was a postdoc in my lab and is now at Case Western, and Sanji Kim. So Sanji collects myon-enhanced CBV weighted fMRI scans in a single slice, 1 millimeter thick, 9.4 Tesla, very high spatial resolution. And we were interested, and this is a orientation column experiment, if any one of you, if those of you that are familiar with Sanji's work in that area. And we were interested in trying to measure the spatial scale of the orientation columns. And we're in essence using this as a real physiological simulation, if you like, because we know there are all these orientation columns and there are estimates of how big they are in the literature. And we want to see if our technique can come up with a reasonably tight number that matches what's in the literature. So this is what we did. We took the original data, and now we're going to bootstrap on top of our split half resampling procedure. So we take a lot of bootstrap samples of the original data sets. We take one of these bootstrap samples and smooth it with a whole series of 2D Gaussian smoothing filters. Let's just look at one of those filters. We feed that into the split half procedure with a GLM. You get one SPM from half the bootstrap sample. You get another SPM from the other independent half of the bootstrap sample. You go ahead and do the correlation procedure. You get a reproducible SPM that looks like that, showing the orientation columns. And you repeat that procedure as a function of the Gaussian smoothing filter. So you get a plot of reproducibility as a function of spatial smoothing scale. You measure the maximum of that curve and repeat across all the bootstrap samples. And we can look at the bootstrap distributions of those maximum values as a function of the underlying spatial scale. You get rather nice, tight histograms suggesting that the spatial scale is just a little above 0.45 millimeters, which actually matches the literature value. It's actually a little bit different than we tend to believe our own. That'll come as a surprise to you. And this is across a whole series of independent data sets in the same cat. So this thing is highly reproducible and reliable, and I recommend this procedure if you're interested in measuring the spatial scale of some part of the brain, which is why we developed it, and we're hoping to go ahead and use it in people in more interesting situations. The fusiform gyrus would be one that I'd be interested in going after if I had some high-resolution fusiform data. And that's all, folks. So what have I told you about? Pipelines as meta models, a range of potential metrics, some of which may be a little dubious in their estimation procedures, and some of which seem to work pretty well. And then four examples of the techniques that we've been, me and my group have been working on for a number of years. And you can't do all this without lots of collaborators, and I'm lucky to have lots of people helping me out. Special thanks to Steve and Morgan, who shared Morgan's PhD thesis work, actually in 21 slides, which took a while to reduce down to the five I showed you. Thanks. How much signal to noise do you want? I mean, the real issue is you have to do a second level resampling, because the real issue is your reproducibility different from noise, right? And the package that we originally released using IDL, so no one used it, we actually had a permutation technique. So it really requires you to do two levels of resampling. So you permute, and then you do your split half on the permutation sample, and you'll get the null distribution on the reproducibility values. And then you can do standard hypothesis testing to see whether your particular unpermuted sample is significantly different from the null. So that's one way of doing it.
Second very good question. You motivated some of the techniques by saying that many of our samples are small, but then you are applying many of your results in small samples too. Doesn't that create a problem in your conclusions about which methods matter and which don't?
No, because I don't need the asymptotic limit to justify any of my statistics. That's one of the advantages of going into the resampling framework. So if I do the double level resampling, then I think I'm okay.
No more questions?
Thank you.